What do you want of me?
Get off my world.
Get off my world. It belongs to me. If you can't handle rejection, then I think you better leave. You can call us fanatics, but the truth is we're hardcore. We love everything there is to know about you know who and more. Get off my world. It belongs to me. Get off my world. It belongs to me.
I just do the best I can.
Hello, people of 2019. You are listening to Get Off My World, a Doctor Who podcast recounted by people who are older than some people and not as old as others.
How is that possible?
And who love the classic series of Doctor Who and also sometimes love the new series of Doctor Who. I am Kelvin.
I'm Pat.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm your guest person, Ariel.
Yes, guest person, Ariel.
Though by now you all might be rather sick of me and have demoted me from guest to the person that regularly just shows up.
Oh, they're sick of everyone.
Haven't you left since last time?
And we can be a little cranky about Doctor Who and fanish things in general, and so we'd like to start on a positive note with something we call temporal grace, something that made us happy in the world of Doctor Who. And Pat, do you have something?
I do, Kelvin. Thank you.
Oh, nice.
So I'm in an online book group with
Doctor Who. What? I sound so unlike you, Pat.
I am, Josh. I co-facilitate it with Jimmy LeDuc, who was a guest on this podcast a few years ago, big Doctor Who fan or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's also a big theater guy, directs a lot of stuff in town. And so he drew my attention to a 2012 National Theater production of Antigone, which we will supply clips of in the show notes. This version starred Christopher Eccleston as Creon and Jodie Whittaker as Antigone. Mm. So I thought, oh, how wonderful is that? And so I wanted to share that with all of our Get Off My World fans.
Two doctors.
In one of the fundamental works of Western drama, yes.
That's pretty incredible.
I know, right?
I hope they tape that and release the Blu-ray or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, because that will be a big seller.
I'll buy it, Ariel.
I hope they lose the footage and animate it.
I want Pat to buy the Blu-ray so I can borrow it from him.
Done.
Well, my temporal grace, I was going to talk about Big Finish again, and then I had this memory of something. I know, and I thought Pat would sigh deeply. And I had this memory of a weird Doctor Who interaction I had a couple weeks ago. I'm a frequent customer at a local tap room where I do a lot of podcast editing, and I was wearing the shirt I'm wearing tonight, which is a picture of a TARDIS on it, and it has Just Be Kind from Peter Capaldi's penultimate episode. And the guy at the counter recognized not just the shirt, but also recognized Just Be Kind and the speech it was from. But what's interesting to me is I still have that Doctor Who embarrassment, and I danced around it with him, and he kind of danced around it too. Like, are you going to know what I'm referencing in the Peter Capaldi speech? You know, that weird Doctor Who fandom that still felt like some sort of
shameful
deviancy that we're both going. Is anyone looking?
I never know how deep into a geek conversation I can go with someone if they recognize, like, my T-shirt or something.
Yeah. But the reality
I really don't know.
It's super mainstream right now. Yeah. I think it's an age thing that I still hang on from childhood, that, like, no one could possibly understand anything about Doctor Who. I'd never meet another Doctor Who fan in a place of normal human interaction.
That's exactly how a normal human would describe those things, Josh.
So I had this weird ambivalent feeling, but afterwards I went, you know what? This is sort of a nostalgic part of my childhood, and that's one piece of awkwardness I will hang on to. The other awkwardness that I am unaware of and other people can inform me of. But that one, I guess I will keep. But now we do occasionally meet eyes awkwardly at the tap room and exchange some bit of Doctor Who trivia.
Well, it's funny because, you know, when I tell people that I'm on this podcast sometimes, and they're like, oh, well, why you? You know, and I'm like, well...
For God's sake!
And I say, well,
after
you know...
they slap me.
Because I'm a woman that likes Doctor Who. And they're like, well, but lots of women like Doctor Who now. And I go, yes, now. You know, and like, I don't think it was ever a point of embarrassment for me because I was lucky enough that I just grew up in this really weird outside of norm society anyway, so I didn't know I was supposed to be embarrassed about it. What I have come to have instead is just this great pride, like, I found this thing. And like, I don't even know, it was just random. It was because I didn't have a television at my house, and when I went to my father's house, he had a TV, but the only thing he would let me watch was the BBC. And so nobody told me to fall in love with it. I didn't have a group of geek friends that were into it. I knew nobody other than me and my father who cared about Doctor Who at all. You know, the thing that I love that's sort of linked into that is I love that it's endured. You know, something like Star Trek or Star Wars continuing makes a lot of sense because they were very huge. But Doctor Who, you know, started out a much smaller fandom. And then the series ended up getting canceled, and yet it then got this reboot and got this huge fandom and was somehow timed out just right to be, you know, appropriate for now's audience. And I think that's really amazing. And I think it's thanks to all the people that wanted to keep writing during the dark time and keep it interesting. And it's thanks to people who wanted to make audiobooks or who wanted to make comics, who found ways that might draw in Doctor Who fans that wouldn't have watched the TV show, but go to a comic book store and pick this up and go, oh, this is kind of a fascinating story. I mean, I think having all these different mediums is really helpful for its continued life. So,
how about you, Kelvin?
This is just a tiny thing, and it involves, oh dear me, a bit of a spoiler for Avengers Endgame.
Uh-oh.
Plug your ears, everyone.
And by the time this actually gets to people...
No one listened to Kelvin.
You know, this will be all over and done with. But I think it can be reasonably assumed from anyone who's been paying attention to the Marvel movies... that Avengers Endgame, that the subject of time travel would come up.
Ariel has not seen it, so keep that in mind. Okay. If you hear a dull humming in the background, listeners...
But there is a scene...
And it's humming out loud.
There is a scene where they're kind of arguing about time travel as a possible solution. And Ant-Man, Paul Rudd, is bringing up all these time travel type...
Fictional
things like Back to the Future and whatever. He does not mention Doctor Who.
I was waiting for it too.
And apparently Doctor Who fans are incredibly upset about this.
But Time Heist, we get a very mediocre episode name checked.
Yes. But I just found it kind of amusing that everyone's like, oh, they mentioned all those time travel stuff. They don't bring up Doctor Who. Like the most obvious time travel thing you could bring up.
Yeah.
You're safe now, Ariel.
It's okay. It's
okay. Okay, great.
I was just entertained by the outrage over that.
It's rare for you to be entertained by outrage. You usually hate outrage.
Dumb outrage.
Double yet.
Not this absolutely justified outrage.
Okay, next up on the podcast, we have Special Topics Dalek. And today's special topic is being provided for us by none other than Mr. Patrick Harrigan.
And hi.
What would that be, Pat?
You guys... I said that I was going to return to this idea of theatrical stuff that Jimmy LaDuke had, Antigone and Creon and blah, 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 blah. So,
I thought you were joking. Oh, my gosh.
So my special topics, Dalek for today is...
Are we auditioning for your play?
Yeah. You guys are all... actors.
I like how there was a pause before that.
That was air quotes for the benefit of the audience. Actors, directors, producers, theatrical types, you know.
Those of the theater.
You're in that milieu. So, thinking about this, what Doctor Who actor, or we'll even say character, would you cast in famous theatrical productions? And so, while you're thinking about this, I'm going to read a little anecdote. This is from Peter Haining's book, Doctor Who, A Celebration, a book that I've been carting around for about 30 years. It's quite water damaged, as people at this table can see.
Were those the tears of a young Pat?
Tears of a young
lonely, isolated Pat.
I think it was when my basement bedroom flooded at some point.
That happened to my precious childhood books, too.
There's an anecdote here that Tom Baker says in his section in this book about a stage production including a memorable appearance in Macbeth at the Shaw Theater in London in 1973. Tom has a funny story to relate about this production, and this is Tom Baker. "I was waiting in the wings one night when someone offered me a peanut," he remembers. "Without thinking, I took it and put it in my mouth. Then as I went on, a bit of the peanut got stuck in my throat. It stuck on my vocal cords, and I was terrified I was about to choke. So I went to the front of the stage and hissed and whispered my soliloquy to the audience. Afterwards, all the actors crowded around me and congratulated me on what they thought had been a master stroke. Even the director asked, 'How did you think of it?' I replied that it hadn't been easy, and then did the same thing every night after." So my answer for this question, of course, is I would like to have seen Tom is in Macbeth in 1973 at the Shaw Theater in London.
I actually came up with a whole cast, a whole little cast for King Lear that I would like to see. Oh, wow. And I think part of that is because I really, really wish I had seen when it came through here and Ian McKellen played Lear and Sylvester McCoy played the Fool. I would have paid good money for that. And I also think it's why Sylvester McCoy ended up as Radagast the Brown. But I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, well, now that he's a lot older, what would it be like to see him play Lear? Mm-hmm. And then from there, I started going on to think, you know, and I think when you're picking an actor from Doctor Who, I'm inherently also including the character because I may not have seen them in anything else. But I'd love to see Michelle Gomez play Goneril, Alex Kingston play Regan, and Pearl Mackey play Cordelia.
Wow. A little side topic. I have the production of King Lear on DVD with Laurence Olivier as Lear, Diana Rigg as one of the daughters, Leo McKern as Gloucester, and John Hurt as the Fool, which is tremendous.
Wow. Of
John Hurt is the Fool, yeah.
Worst thing in the world, my ex-boyfriend worked for the Guthrie, and he sent me a picture of him arm-in-arm with Sylvester McCoy. And was like, guess who I'm hanging out with right now? And I did not forgive him for a very long time.
Put the knife in.
That's dagger in the heart stuff, yeah.
Well, what about Peter Davison in Spamalot? Oh, wait.
Classic, dude.
I immediately thought of Colin Baker as Stanley in Streetcar Named Desire. and then you can have Perry as Blanche and Mel as Stella.
I would describe that as unconventional, but yeah, okay.
Does this mean we have to see him with his shirt off?
Yes. See him with his shirt off more.
The only thing I could think of is that I would really like to see, and I have no idea what his singing voice is like, but I kind of want to see Peter Capaldi be Sweeney Todd.
That's kind of nice.
Yeah.
Whereas the judge is Judge Turpin.
Yeah, some just huge operatic level villain.
He could do that. He wears capes. Well. And long coats, long Victorian coats.
How many doctors could we get into Glengarry Glenn Ross?
Could we do 12? Could we do 12 angry men?
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Oh. All the doctors is 12 angry men. Oh,
who would play the Henry Fonda character? Who would be the voice of reason?
You know? I think it'd have to be Peter Davison.
Peter Davison, yeah.
Does he have the gravitas? Does he have the moral authority?
Yeah. Old Peter Davison does.
You know, I think it's a Capaldi character, don't you? I'm not convincing you.
No.
But if we sit here, I'll convince you.
Maybe Eccleston? I don't know.
I think he's the guy who's probably like, I just want to get home and watch the baseball game. Right? You remember him?
Can we just get through this, please?
He's like, I just want to, he's amoral.
He wants to get out as soon as possible, just like Dr.
So who's the super confrontational juror who's like in everyone's face?
Well, it could be Hartnell.
Could be Colin.
Or could even be Tom. Or Tom. There's a lot of confrontational doctors.
Or Pearl. It's a repertory thing. They'll play the different roles at different
times. Every time I hear about Eccleston wanting to get out, I'm just sad.
It breaks my heart.
Really liked him as the doctor.
I really did.
And I wonder if he's sad about it, too.
I don't think he's sad.
You don't think so?
He's going off to do Antigone at the National Theater and play Dark Elves in Thor of the Dark World. Yeah. Well, maybe sad about that. But and Destro in Rise of Korra.
Oh, God.
But we're getting far afield of the topic here. But, you know, I mean, clearly Samuel Beckett plays are the way to go here.
Yeah.
Tom Baker and Patrick Troughton in Waiting for Godot.
Yeah, or you could even do a classic new series team up if you put Tom Baker and Matt Smith. I'm thinking of those very physical quirky actors.
Yeah, you know, and the elderly ones you just stick in the garbage cans, and they don't need to move very much.
Or if you did Matt Smith and Eccleston in Dumbwaiter, would be really great. Oh. Eccleston is the, like, one who ends up wanting to kill Matt Smith. Matt Smith is sort of the fool. Because I'd really like to see Matt Smith play a fool. Like, he's got the right kind of bigness for that.
Matt Smith in a musical version of American Psycho. Oh, wait.
I can't picture that. I cannot get that idea in my head.
I'm trying to assign Jodie Whittaker to certain roles, and there are many big, important roles for women in theater, but because she's the only female Doctor Who, I don't want to be like, well, of course she'll play Medea, or of course she'll play Medea. There's no particular reason why she would be good at Medea.
She'd be really great in Arcadia, actually, as Hannah.
Yeah.
She is very good at making it clear that she's capable of being a rational woman. And so I actually look to the parts in which the woman is a strong, rational character. I don't want to see her play Lady M or Medea. I don't want to see that kind of a big, loud character. I want to see her be, you know, smart.
The first thing I think of, and this is probably too on the nose, but would be like Eliza Doolittle.
Yeah. Well, she can play with her accents.
Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, a real, I'm not going to take any crap from you, Victorian working class woman.
And of course, we've already seen that dynamic with Tom Baker and Louise Jameson back in the original day.
I would have loved to have seen Tennant do Much Ado. Who did he do that with? Donna. It's Donna. That's who it is.
Oh, jeez.
The two of them did a stage production of Much Ado together that I would have paid so much money to have seen. Oh, yeah.
That's fun.
I want to see David Tennant and Donna in Tony and Tina's Wedding.
Oh, God. And, of course, next up we have the randomizer and its curiously Harrigan-esque voice has, of all things, picked the second Sixth Doctor story, Attack of the Cybermen, written by Paula Moore, which is a pseudonym, I understand.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
I can't remember who directed it offhand.
They probably don't remember it.
They probably don't remember it. And I will start this off by saying, this is a bad Doctor Who story. I do not like this story. There's very little about it I am positive about. I think it's terrible. I think they do things like have the TARDIS go back to Trotter's Lane, and it just means nothing.
Trotter's, not Trotter's.
Trotter's Lane, fine.
Opinion invalidated.
And they repair the chameleon circuit, and they do nothing with it. They don't even make good jokes out of it. Perry is... She's scared of an image of Halley's Comet on a view screen.
Actually, yes. This is
what the heck?
This is exactly what I got into. Is like, she is anxious about everything. Like, her voice is terrified when she's talking about, like, biscuits. It doesn't matter. She's just always in this really scared place, Doctor.
Quick actor side note. Do you think that stutter is a accent trick? Something she learned to do to kind of get her American accent in place?
But why does it always have to be terrified? Because she always sounds
scared. Well, the reason
scared.
I think it's a tick is because it doesn't always belong. She does it when it doesn't make sense.
Any sense.
I want to hear more from Kelvin, though. And I got to say, Kelvin, bold forward defense on this. This is solid. This is good. No, I'm happy for you.
It's called Attack of the Cybermen. How much attacking do the Cybermen do?
We don't even see them until 24 minutes in.
Yeah, and they're just kind of hiding around in the sewer, not really doing much of anything, and you bring back, I can't think of his name, the guy from Resurrection of the Daleks.
Lytton.
They bring back Lytton, do nothing with him. Really. Nothing.
We get an entire new perspective on his character, Kelvin, and his fists get bloodied.
Josh, this is Kelvin's moment.
And he gets killed in a manner that has no dramatic impact whatsoever. The location footage is... Let's just stick the camera out the window and see what's there. I mean, even by Doctor Who standards for a like contemporary set story, it's terrible. And I don't like the story. I don't like the story. It's not good.
But, well, Calvin, do you like the story?
No, I do not.
So for round four of Get Off My World... Oh, no, we're going to dig into this a little bit here. Well, I think... Thank you, Calvin. You've made your position quite clear. I think you have a number of nested points that are eloquently expressed and difficult to refute, although I'm sure Josh will try.
I love that when you try to intellectualize ranting.
That's my whole brand, Kelvin.
You're trying to deconstruct my rants.
I will say that I agree with Kelvin in that this is not a particularly great Doctor Who story from a rational, objective point of view. It is overstuffed. The music is frequently inexplicable.
Oh, God, the music is so bad!
And 80s Cybermen are just objectively cracked.
Now this is Josh's turn.
Sidebar quickly.
I forgot to mention the music. It's so bad.
Clarence Weathern did an entire wonderful afunctionalism about the music in this episode back in episode 12 of Get Off My World.
We'll
so I encourage everybody to link back to that, yes.
However, I just find it highly entertaining. I sat back for the entire episode. I meant to have it on the background, and I just sat back and smiled to myself. This is, to me, Doctor Who does an action movie. This is Doctor Who does, you know, Quentin Tarantino Who. I'm losing people fast.
But
everyone's deleting the podcast offer iPod right now.
I love how bloody violent it is. I love Colin Baker in it. It just makes me smile.
I'm really sad now because normally I think of you and I as the two like positive people when it comes to like arguing about the episode, and I have nothing positive to say about this episode whatsoever.
I can't rationally tell anyone to enjoy it. I understand why people don't enjoy it.
There's a lot of indefensible things I like too.
I'm gonna thread the needle on this a little bit here. This I don't particularly like. Attack of the Cybermen, but I don't hate it the way that Kelvin does. It's sort of unusual because it's pretty bad. But there are a few things that I've always admired about it. One is that this is one of the few Cybermen episodes where you get a sense of their physical strength. The director made a point of doing this over and over again.
They give the Vulcan shoulder pinch?
Yes, episode one, the Cyberman presses his finger into Litton's shoulder and he goes, ah! And then they press their fists against Griffith's skull, they press the doctor's shoulder, they press Griffith's hand, they crush the Cryon's shoulder, and eventually at the end, they smash Litton's fists with their cyber hands. As a kid, this was very striking to me, because like I'd seen the Cybermen a lot, but I was like, whoa, that's horrible. Also, and I don't think I can go very much down this road without getting out of PG-13 territory, but Perry's Top, how much can I talk about this? family-friendly. This was really formative for me.
As the woman watching this episode, my first thought was, take off the heels. You are traversing down the sewer, mincing around in your heels. Take them off.
Yeah. Didn't have my eyes on the heels. Yeah.
You guys were both thinking take something off, but it was totally different.
No, I confess the pink spandex.
Yeah.
No reason to be there.
It's
top.
Ludicrous.
It had an impact.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't have much to add to what you guys have said other than my notes were continually, oh my God, this is boring. Oh God. Oh God. but the one thing that really struck me in this episode was that the Sixth Doctor is really mean. Like, he is not a real nice guy. And it kind of like made me think of other moments where I remember as a child just being like, I thought I loved the Doctor, but this guy's really a jerk. And then he shoots a Cyberman. Like, it's so rare for the Doctor to commit an act
doctor
of violence.
The Cyberman.
Yeah, I suppose
Tom
he did.
Baker
but it,
blew
but it
people
still,
up left and right.
I want to talk about that scene a little bit,
but it affected me. Mm-hmm. Like, it was the only part of this that affected me. I was like, no.
It's striking because the Doctor doesn't frequently, like, blow people away with guns. Although, you're right, Josh, it's not, like, completely uncommon. But I looked at it again. What happens is the Doctor shoots a Cyberman. That Cyberman flips around and, because it's dying, accidentally shoots another Cyberman who shoots him back. And then the Doctor shoots the Cyber Leader from the ground. So there were three Cybermen. The Doctor took care of two of them. And I think there was just some line where, like, well, we can't have Colin Baker just be all Rambo on all the Cybermen. So they had to do this kind of semi-slapstick thing where they start shooting each other.
Do you think that was the choreography or just because those laser blasts are so ill-defined?
Yeah, the optical effect department. Yeah. It was just like, I don't know what's going on. We'll just slap them
because
on.
The Doctor is at his most Rambo throughout this. I don't think anyone was like, whoa, we better be careful.
Well, he jumps down and clops the cop.
It's like extended fisticuffs.
Yeah, that also
I
threw me.
I love
like
it to death because it's just like, smack, pow, biff.
Yeah, he jumps down there and comes back up and he's like, he's been silenced. And I'm like, who are you?
Yes, Perry threatened to shoot a cop.
The early Sixth Doctor was like unusually cold-blooded about stuff.
Especially these very early episodes.
Yeah.
This is just episode number two.
Yeah.
And next one is Vengeance on Varos, which has a lot of the same sort of thing going
where,
on.
Where like except a guy dies from an acid bath.
Except it's a better story. Where he's unjustified.
But it's still not very doctor-like.
His rudeness is more unjustified than his violence.
Yeah.
I thought it was just like a refreshing, like, what if the doctor just said, instead of talking, I have two fists, these guys are trying to murder millions of people, I'm going to just punch him and save half an hour of blathering.
He also didn't know that they were anything but normal police officers, I think, at the time. He just, like, it was a street vigilante, like, beating the hell out of constables on the streets of contemporary London.
You're just selling it more to me.
I'm not saying I object to it.
It just went up in my estimation.
Josh's message to the listeners, go ahead and punch cops.
But it has the quintessential season 22 Sixth Doctor line when he says, I shall beat him into submission with my charm. It's one of my favorite Sixth Doctor lines because it's like, yep. And if that doesn't work, I'll punch him in his face.
In the end, this is like such a blender of 1980s Doctor Who ideas that I can't help but enjoy it. Like, it's so strange, you know. And now we're in contemporary London, and now we're on Telos. And why are the Cybermen so fragile? Like, at least two of them get taken down with handguns, of all things. And two of them get their heads knocked off by metal clubs.
But they show that those guys are Cybermen rejects, and they have Cyberman arm, so I assume they had more strength. I'm thinking.
But Griffith shot one in the sewers, which is clearly a guy left over from the invasion. And we haven't even talked about the fan service in this, which is
so deep.
Yeah, there's continuity with the invasion and revelation of the Daleks with Lytton and the Sinister Cops.
Resurrection.
Resurrection. Excuse me. Tomb of the Cybermen, of course. And the 10th Planet, because this is literally the Cybermen trying to go back in time and stop their planet from blowing up in the very first appearance of the Cybermen. Those are really deep cuts for pre-video
age. I think that's partly what upsets me so much about this story is that it does have all these unusually deep continuity things with Doctor Who, which Doctor Who normally kind of doesn't do very well.
It has Terry Davros Malloy in it as Russell, the undercover cop.
And it's got Michael Kilgariff as the cyber controller or cyber leader, the same guy who played that role from Tomb of the Cybermen back in 1967, even though he's clearly
old and tubby. And,
you know, he's still alive, still going. He's like 6'7 and whatever. I don't know. I mean, good for Michael Kilgariff. But somebody was like, we're going to do all these continuity references and we're going to get all these actors back, and wow.
I really like the Cryons. I know they're ridiculous, but they're really interesting because they're.
I wanted to like the Cryons
because they're really proactive. They have this strange kind of delicate air, but they're planning to murder all the Cybermen, and they'll kill themselves to do it.
I am really fully with you on that. They look stupid, and their name is stupid, but I dig them. And they're this fae. Displaced native race.
And the actors are super in it. Like, they're in it, you know?
You're looking very blue.
I just wanted to see more from the Cryons than that. Because they are kind of intriguing with the weird fainness and the elegant motions.
Again, something Russell Davies should have brought back.
Yeah.
Which it could have done a lot with, I think. I also wish they had done more with the heist element at the beginning. I actually like the thuggish criminal set that Lytton puts together.
Well,
the guy who plays Griffiths is really cool. The bald guy. Mm-hmm. I love that guy.
Isn't he in the Campion with Peter Davis? And he's his
I don't know.
Butler. So there is an extra doctor.
I think dude was
there.
Like a professional boxer at some point.
Yeah, but he's also an actor. He's in a number of different British TV shows.
He does look like British gangster straight out of Central Casting.
No,
and he has that great line with the Cryon when she is trying to sell him on joining the gang, and the Cryon says, as a professional, we realize your time is valuable. And he's like, are you putting me on? Are you winding me up?
He gets a lot of great lines. He says, I'm finding all of this disturbing. Cybermen, Daleks, now time travel in an organ.
But you have to turn off your brain and just kind of glide across the surface, and so many things are packed into it that's why I find it entertaining. I get it why you might find this boring, but to me, there's never a dull moment.
You know,
there's nothing deep to go think about, but on the surface, it's just like a 80s party mix.
You know why it sucks, though? It's because Eric Sayward clearly wrote it. It's got a pseudonym.
Eric Sayward. There's a lot of credit
and controversy with this story.
Yeah, I encourage our listeners to go deep down that rabbit hole and try to figure out who actually wrote this thing.
The general idea, and if you watch it, it makes sense. It's Ian Levine providing all the continuity and then the hard-boiled action stuff. Undercover cop shooting a Cyberman point blank in the face several times until ooze comes out. That's Eric Sayward. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it all clocks. It's just who this third writer was and how involved she was.
Which we think is maybe Eric Sayward's wife, but that was just kind of a fiction so he could get around the union rules. I don't know.
They had to use a pseudonym for some reason, and there are like three different writers who claim like, oh, I wrote most of this, or...
Cyber Litton shivs a Cyberman.
Yeah.
It's so unlike any other piece of Doctor Who. I can't help but love it for its weird out there in its own realm.
One other thing that bugged the hell out of me about this. How did the Cyberman get into the TARDIS?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did have a note on, like, that was super sloppy. You just left it unlocked for, like, the only time you've ever done that.
Yeah, you know, like, they go back into the TARDIS and the Doctor immediately gets strangled by a Cyberman.
Yeah, no temporal grace in the TARDIS in this episode. That's
pretty cool. Like, why the TARDIS is crawling with Cybermen?
Organs don't lock, right? Isn't it when it's an organ?
The what's-their-faces went into the TARDIS in Time of the Ronnie, but I guess that was because they left the door open because he had just regenerated, so that made sense. But
it's just probably a reference to Earthshock. The Cybermen now just have a key made and Earthshock.
Next time we show up. And then
the Ace Hardware. Excellent.
But in the Five Doctors, they were
trying to... The Cyber Leader is the greatest locksmith in the galaxy. We will get into the TARDIS.
But they were trying to blow it open in the Five Doctors with those big bombs that Turlough was worried about. Oh, I know.
I think we can say in summary, classic.
Kelvin, we're at round four now, aren't we?
We are, yes.
Yes, this is our wonderful afunctionalism round, and I believe you have something to share for us tonight. I know what it is.
Yeah.
Because I heard you do it at a spoken word thing a few months ago.
Yeah. Its genesis was as a Doctor Who story. Like, this was going to evolve into a Doctor Who story, but it's not. This is like the opening for a Doctor Who story, basically what it is. There's no Doctor Who-related material in this, but it would be like the event that sets the plot rolling. And it was a thing I did for Reverend Matt Kesson's Monster Science.
Frequent guest on this podcast.
Frequent guest on the podcast. And he had a show that was themed on the Ice Age. And I did a little story about mammoths. You're not going to mess this up with your hippie shit, Carl said for the umpteenth time. He said that same phrase, or some close variant of it, continuously during the entire 14-hour flight, and the helicopter and limo rides to wherever here was. A grim, fortress-like bunker in the remotest part of Siberia. Something from the Stalin era that had never been torn down, in a huge concrete room converted into a dining hall at once severe and opulent. And he was whispering it now as they mixed with the others. And since Carl described everything from herbal tea to capital gains taxes as hippie shit, it was like everything else he said, essentially meaningless. She had an MBA from Columbia. How much hippie shit could she possibly be into? But as the individual, Shauna had stopped thinking of him as a person, who cut her generous checks for whatever this trip was for, she remained bright-eyed and chipper. Yes, Carl, absolutely. No hippie shit. She endured the toasting, surprisingly enough. To your health, to our future, to our gracious host. Oh, her head swam like a sleepy whale, but somehow she kept her words from slurring and her body from swaying. She was not a vodka drinker by temperament, and she found the genuine top-shelf Russian article not appreciably different from the sauce foisted on her at fraternity mixers. But some tolerance had apparently held on over the years. It was certainly less harsh, properly chilled. And in a way,
it seemed an excuse to eat these wonderful appetizers the Russians called zakuski. Fine vinegary salads with tomato, cucumber, and cabbage, and the best pickles she had ever had. Which even had room left for dinner. There was also some sort of charcuterie and sausage, but mercifully she managed to avoid those. The small talk, never her thing. Especially not with Russians who barely spoke English and Americans who barely spoke Russian. She clung to the one Russian who seemed passably bilingual and safe. A surprisingly young fellow named Maxim, and followed his lead. She cranked the charm up to a point where she felt like a complete fraud. An American professional woman seemed to strike much of the oligarch's guests as an amusing novelty. In a more somber moment, she may have kicked the lot of them in the teeth for their condescension. But no. Carl needed this ambiguous deal with this mysterious Russian money man badly, and no doubt any expectation of respect would be interpreted as hippie shit. So she smiled, brushed her hair over her ear, and giggled at times where she felt it was appropriate. Finally, dinner was served. Overwhelming. She had no idea salad could be so heavy. And a soup that she supposed was borscht. She saw the hunks of meat floating within, and so she just sort of stirred it without eating. Carl glared at her. More hippie shit. But the Russians were too absorbed in their own discussions to notice. After the first courses, the great man stood up and gave some sort of speech. It was Shauna's first good look at him. Shorter than she would have thought. She expected some sort of Putin-esque arrogance, some imperial figure that radiated power, but he was not like that at all. In fact, he was stunningly ordinary. He could have been any number of financial middle managers she'd worked with, only more expensively dressed. She looked at Maxim, and he dutifully provided whispered translations.
He thanks you for being here. He tells of big success hunting. He mentioned business deal. Now he talk of main course.
Here Maxim paused, making eye contact with his countrymen, sharing awed whispers. Shauna felt a chill. She prodded Maxim, maybe a little too hard. What was going on? Maxim struggled with the English. He
talked to scientists for many years. They find it. They find it in ice. It's still fresh, very, very rare. They cook for us.
Shauna stared at him. Find what in ice? She hissed, immediately embarrassed by her unconscious aping of his Russian phrasing. Maxim did not have the words, making some odd gestures, like indicating a long nose and big ears. Shauna froze. No way. The waitstaff wheeled it in on silver serving trays and removed the covers with a flourish. Steaks. Huge steaks. It had been ages since Shauna had eaten steak, and the smell of grilled meat now, after years of vegetarianism, made her gag. But this was worse. It did not smell like beef. This was deeper, richer, and somehow very, very old. Mammoth. They had found a mammoth frozen somewhere in the Arctic ice, preserved, and they had cut it up for steaks. Carl shot her a warning glance as he straightened his napkin. No hippie shit. You're eating this. The other guests readied their knives and forks, eagerly anticipating this rarest of meals. The waiter slid the steak onto her plate off an ornate silver serving fork. She fought to conceal her horror. She could not abide eating an animal, and somehow eating an animal 15,000 years dead was even worse. It was like being asked to devour a monument. As if Frenchmen were asked to chew the Eiffel Tower down to its rivets. Meat was murder to her, but this was sacrilege. The men dug in and ate happily. Shauna fought back tears. Chewing a huge mouthful, Carl reached over and tapped her plate with his knife. Three deliberate taps. Eat it. No hippie shit. You know, screw you, Carl. The hippie shit starts now. Maybe it was the vodka that caused her to act the way she did. The sudden wave of woozy calm she felt in the face of this desecration. But no, it was too profound to be simple drunkenness.
this inexplicable feeling like a powerful voice from beyond whispering, "Fear not." It seemed like the men had started choking from eating too greedily. But the noises were too deep, too resonant to be mere choking. Their hair, once precisely coiffed, became messy, matted, spreading across their faces and bodies. Bellies swelled, popping buttons and bursting seams. Ralph Lauren jackets split under massive, spreading backs. Fingers grew stubby, vanishing into thick palms attached to broadening limbs. Teeth punctured gums and grew outward farther and farther, impossibly long and curled. Noses elongated, at first silly, like some parody of Cyrano, but then far, far beyond that. And they grew. All of them grew and grew. Shauna sat still, too awed to move. The mammoth herd regarded her, the concrete room huge enough to contain and support their bulk as they surrounded her in judgment. And still, no fear. The whispering voice, if it could be called that, soothing her. She met their eyes, huge and old and questioning. There was a clear intelligence in those eyes, a strange intelligence. There was nothing human in it. Not exactly older than man, not precisely smarter than man, but wiser and somehow more complete. Understanding passed between Shauna and the mammoth intelligence. Yes. Yes. Two of the mammoths tramped across the room to the steel and glass double doors that led outside, smashing it apart with their tusks and trunks, then widening the gap with their enormous heads and forelimbs. A trivial task for these giants. And as the herd marched outside, one mammoth, Shauna thought it may have been Maxim, if it was still Maxim in any respect, gently scooped her up with his trunk and set her upon his back. Shauna glowed. She had never felt such joy and power. And the mammoths and their queen strode out into this new world, which after so many, many years, would once again be theirs.
This is round five, and we are going to dip back into the War Master box set from
Arcs
Big Finish.
Infinity!
Which is part of our round five Arcs of Infinity! And today we'll be talking about the last two stories in the first War Master box set, which is The Skyman by James Goss and The Heavenly Paradigm by Guy Adams. And The Skyman picks up roughly where we left off last time and in the second story of the box set, where we have introduced a pseudo-companion for the Master in the form of Cole. And Cole decides to save a planet from the Time War, and the Master indulges this request, and they materialize in a primitive, agrarian-type world, and the Master basically steps out of the story, or kind of steps out of the story, and lets Cole attempt to save this planet from the Time War, and that's pretty much the story as it unfolds.
He's a sky man waiting in the sky.
Yeah, and it's like a total random decision. Like, here, pick one. Like, okay, that one.
I liked that. This sort of completely arbitrary nature of, mm-hmm. like, what does a hero let live and die that the Master just literalizes? Well, what are you going to let live and what are you going to let die? And Cole decides, that one, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was never quite clear on exactly how he thought he was going to save a planet in the first place, or why he would even be a threat, except I guess that they're all at threat because of the Time War.
The Master, haha, funny. That. The Master pretty much says, every one of these planets you see is going to be destroyed, pick one.
It comes out of losing the hospital planet in the last episode, and that they could just look up into the sky and see whole chunks of the universe disappearing. I mean, yeah, it's a pretty broad request, and I think you have to buy into that or the story falls apart. But
I felt a lot of discontinuity between the different parts of the box set, too. Like, shouldn't we know Cole a little better by this time? Shouldn't we have a little better clarity on why the Master finds him miraculous? Maybe it was just that I found episode two so confusing that I was like, what? I don't. And I kept thinking, why doesn't Cole not realize that this guy is a horrible monster? Like, he's clearly evil.
But I think that's some of the purpose that is obscured on your first listen of the second story, is that the Master in that story, as even the alien entities they encountered, tell Cole and the other people that this master is better than he thinks. Is right. Also, he saved them all from the Daleks and attempted to save the planet. And we also have Cole feeling guilt because the master told him it was his fault for touching the temporal grace orb or whatever it was in the second story. So I do think it is set up. I, of course, listened to this twice, so it runs more on a thematic engine than a narrative one. Yeah. Occasionally.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's by far my favorite of the four.
Oh, me too.
It's got the strongest concept. It's got very good performances. The guy who plays Cole is very good. The other characters are on the rural planet. Or, no, that's a southern accent. I can't do a Yorkshire accent or whatever.
Yeah, it was West Country, I would say.
Yeah.
Simple folk planet.
It's West Country.
Simple folk planet. Like, mm-hmm. I liked this idea that they were like, we know that technology can lead to war. We want to be peaceful people. We are not allowing ourselves to access that. I just thought that was cool. Yeah.
Sure, they're intentional back to naturists.
Yeah. You don't often see full-on Luddite sympathies like positively portrayed. They're always portrayed as being idiots or something.
Yeah, no, I thought they were quite sympathetic. I thought they're relatively three-dimensional. I mean, they're broad types that were sketched out, but it worked out pretty well.
You need to do that. It's a 50-minute story, an hour story. Yeah.
And you can't rely on visual techniques. Everything has to happen within dialogue. And the central moral issue is interesting because it's not clear-cut, and it's clearly weighted on the side of the master. Like, what the master wants to do is to convince Cole that he never should have gone there in the first place because he has this sadistic element to it. It's like, look what you did. You messed everything up. But they wouldn't have been just fine. They would have died because the plague would have wiped them out.
I felt in a way his lesson was more like, yeah, you can try to do good or you can be a bad guy, but in the end it might all just come out the same, so why not just be me and enjoy this fine wine?
Yeah, yeah. Do you think, like, the master is genuinely interested in winemaking, or is this just, like, bull crap he pulls out to, like,
it could be like
stringing Cole along?
I think he wants to be there. Yeah. Like, I think he wants to be down there watching Cole fail, drawing out this awful arc that's happening and getting off on it the whole time.
He's obviously enjoying the thematic parallels between the time it takes to grow grapes and have his plans come to fruition. And it's just that practicality of the master. It's like, if I have to wait a while, I'm going to at least have wine.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about it.
It's an airy anti-humanist sort of thing to do, right? Yeah. It's like, I'm not engaged with any human being. I'm not even, like, writing my memoirs or anything.
It's very Time Lordy. I can just spend 3 years not caring about anything because that's like a day to me.
Yeah.
And exactly. So the constant going back to see the master was an interesting format. And I was saying that sometimes for me, one of my faults with listening to audiobooks is I get like super into the sound of it, and then I get a little sleepy sometimes. And for me, constantly going back like refreshed me over and over again. Mm-hmm.
It had a good shape. A rondo shape to it. He would keep coming back to him.
And because of the previous two stories, the master hangs over it like a sort of Damocles. Like he's actually his scariest in this entire box set, sitting alone growing grapes. His not participating is scary. He's like, what the hell are you doing, master? What do you know? When are you going to kill everybody?
This is interesting. I wasn't that crazy about this story when I read it, but talking about it now, I like it a lot more. Mm-hmm. I remember being sort of annoyed that it's a story about the master during the Time War, and he's not really in it. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, even with Doctor Who, those are some of the most interesting episodes. Like when they take the Doctor somewhat out of the story and focus on the companion's journey.
Yeah, in the end, I had mixed feelings about it. I think it's the best done of the four. You know, like I said, I thought the acting was quite good. But to me, it was ultimately too schematic. It was like I knew that there was, he's just going to sit back and watch Cole destroy this world. I didn't know in exactly what form that was going to take, but that was clear from minute one.
I was a little disappointed that, like, what happened was a cheap knockoff of Cybermen.
I actually was wondering if they were going to actually be the Cybermen.
I kind of felt like, come on,
that'd be great.
I kind of felt like it would wind up being the Cybermen, but like they wouldn't go that far.
I'm with Ariel. I thought, is this like when the Master says at the end of the Capaldi season that, or Capaldi says it, that on any planet when there's humans, there's eventually going to be Cybermen. Yeah. They didn't quite make that additional step.
Yeah, but I read it as almost a parody of Doctor Who monsters. The Master sets him up to create a Doctor Who monster with a catchphrase of, you know, repent or no, no retribution. Mm-hmm. And I found that extra amusing. It did obviously have notes of the Cybermen, but also of the Daleks too, in their like lack of mercy and that they wanted to destroy.
You don't, and it tells me you don't need evil to make evil.
No,
like good intentions make evil. I mean, the thing that stuck with me in this whole thing was the phrase "Every choice was yours."
Mm-hmm. But it totally wasn't though, because he didn't give him enough information to make an informed moral decision. Like the Master knew well. The
decision was to go down and meddle or not, though. I think that's.
Well, what kind of decision is that? You meddle all the time. Everyone meddles. He had good intentions, and
to me, there's a lot of these. The frustration with it is the fun because you don't have a hero. The stories are at their heart not fair because the protagonist is a mass murderer.
This is Patricia Highsmith's novel Ripley's Game.
Yeah,
translated into a Doctor Who concept. And she had 300 pages to do that tremendous, wonderful novel, and this had 65 minutes or something. So the comparison is not fair, but the satanic figure to just like, I'm going to allow you these opportunities to eventually destroy yourself and your entire life is, bleh. I don't know, you guys, I mean, like, it's so dark, these stories. I don't know if I need,
very dark.
Especially with the fourth one. Let's talk about the last one now, too.
How much I like it's dark. Like, I like when there's, like, some awful moral dilemma or something doesn't work out in the end or, like.
Oh, I love those things, too. But, I mean, cruelty for the sake of cruelty, I don't know that I need in my life right now.
No, it's but like, there was a weird, hard, awful lesson in this to me.
What was learned? What was learned?
Have a living will. Make sure no one is going to put you in a robot suit and extend your life beyond what you want.
Well, Carrie and I have already agreed.
Be aware of what you choose to implant on people as something that might save their life or might be good for them in some way may not be maybe poison.
I guess.
You know?
That sounds like a recipe
you can't
for
come
radical
in as a savior.
Non-intervention, though.
And I find that interesting in the overall Doctor Who canon because these stories are following so many Doctor Who tropes, but I feel like by putting the Master in the center of them, they get turned on their heads. And even when you kind of know how they're going to end, they feel fresh, even though really dark.
Well, Clara came in trying to solve things in the last, or in her last Peter Capaldi season, too, and things didn't work out very well because there's some sort of moral authority that the Doctor exerts, and when she goes out from under his wing, things get screwed up. And here the Master and his companion, he deliberately removes himself. And so that's a little worrying, too. It's like humans can't make their own decisions without the guidance of some godlike Time Lord. And I don't want to go too far down this road because any thematic concept in Doctor Who is going to be undermined by the next story in Doctor Who. But it's there.
And the morality here is within the confines of Doctor Who morality, right? Because it is responding to other messages in Doctor Who. So it's so far diluted from an actual, like, worldview.
Yeah, when things get translated too far out of everyday experience, the moral lessons get abstracted too much.
Before we move on to the next story, I just do have to say I love the mob that inadvertently gets sent to the Master's door, and they just go outside and like, do you hear screaming?
Right. Like, what are you doing to them? I don't know. So the Heavenly Paradigm wraps up this set of four stories.
And it's another incident where they put the Master in a Doctor Who story. It's the Master doing End of the Time War.
And showing up in another sort of bland suburb. Like,
it's the Heavenly Paradigm instead of the Moment.
Oh, yeah.
But it's him making the same
choice. I didn't even make
choice.
That connection, but you're right. Yeah. I kept getting tripped up on the horror of glam rock, which is the same 1970s period.
There's a strangely large number of audio adventures that are set in the 70s.
I know, it's like when the writers grew up, right?
Yeah, I suppose.
So,
but there were still some things that I found happening in this, or weirdly that I could see being both the doctor and the master's actions too. Like, for example, sort of allowing your companion to drink the boozy tea to get knocked out so that you can have the important conversation about the weapons that you have to have. Right. I mean, that actually felt like I could have seen the exact same thing happen.
That's what's interesting is the first three episodes tell you how different the master is in a traditional Doctor Who story, and then we have the master doing exactly what the doctor actually did in the new series.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I thought
in different ways.
Performance wise, this was really good. I loved the computer. I loved the old woman. I thought that scene where Cole gets knocked out, and then the little conversation between her and the master just drops really, really good. That actor was tremendous. At the same time, all of these Time War stories seem to revolve around some mega super crazy weapon that the Time Lords decide is too impossible to use.
But it's playing on the fact that you've seen this story again and again, and it's mirroring the moment story.
I know.
And tying directly into the new series.
But how postmodern can we get?
Shocking.
The Master and Doctor both would make the same statement. Yeah. I do what I think is right.
How many times can we see Pop eat itself?
I guess my main thing about this is, okay, this is set in the 70s.
For some reason.
When the Roger Delgado master is on Earth, I got into this thing of like, well, why did the Roger Delgado regeneration of the master just never go here? If this was there, you know?
Or maybe he found out in later years.
Yeah, like...
Or
like,
also time has been rewritten so much, and that's another thing we haven't even talked about, that all of continuity is apparently just thrown into the blender and anything could be true.
You would think the doctor would know that there is like a secret cache of Time Lord weaponry on Earth.
Yeah. Because he's the master. The master would know that. The master would know where every secret cache of weapons is. Like,
or at least we'll learn it at some point.
Yeah.
I figured out the sash of Rassilon will keep me from getting sucked into a black hole. Like, wait, what?
I just, you know, one of the things that came to me listening to this box set, I could listen to five more box sets of The Master. I love his unapologetic selfishness and, like, opinion of himself. And, you know, there's the line where somebody says to him, you could be the most wonderful man in the universe. And he goes, I already am.
He questions himself less than the doctor. He has better self-esteem in this version.
He makes a statement of purpose toward the end, which is still a little unclear. I mean, he just says, like, I'm basically out for myself. That's what he claims. That's not true from what we've seen of the master since the 1970s. It's like, no, we want universal domination. We don't care whether we destroy the entire universe in Legopolis or whatever. So, okay, some of that is because Anthony Ainley's master was different from the Delgado master, and Michelle Gomez was apparently giving birthday presents to Peter Capaldi or whatever her motivation was. So the master has never been terribly clear on motivation.
In the context of Big Finish 2, this box that surprised me, because usually they want to leave everything open-ended, that they chose to start their War Master audios by connecting it straight up to Utopia.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting the Chameleon Arch to come in to it.
Nobody expects the Chameleon
Arch. I didn't even... Got you with the Chameleon Arch again.
Well, there are two main weapons, fear, and surprise. That's three weapons.
But, you know, it's been 40 years, and I only just now made the connection that the Doctor and the Master are both terms of higher education.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, only listening to this, I was like, oh, is there a bachelor running around? Is there an undergraduate out there? Because I'm going to write that one.
They're BFA. I'm going to be a BFA.
I am the associate. This brings us to an end to another episode of Get Off My World, and another one will be coming sometime in the future.
The future!
The future! 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 Until then, I am Kelvin.
I'm Pat.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm Ariel.
And we are saying,
get off my world!
I have thought about trying to write a story of, like, a Time Lord who was sort of trying to be like the Doctor, but just not doing a very good job of it, and he was calling himself the Surgeon.
Oh, I left the sonic screwdriver inside the patient. Damn it.